أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله، أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله،
Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. Today we have our fourth program in our series dealing with the political system of Islam. We'll be continuing with our discussion of the selection of rulers in Islamic State. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on in our third program in this series last week before we get into today's topic?
Okay. In the first part of program three, we discussed the basic purpose behind the establishment of an Islamic state, and we said that it is basically to establish justice, and we indicated again the variety of opinions given by the jurist on the basis of the Quranic provision in terms of what need to be achieved. And we said that this is a near unanimous position that has been taken by Muslim jurists. We discussed some of the, you know, very insignificant, very minor opinion that might have emerged at one time or the other. But we said the consensus is basically that it is imperative to have an Islamic system. And then we moved on to the ruler itself, and we said that there is no particular title, even though the title caliph or khalifa or successor to the Prophet in conducting the affairs of the believers is a common type of term. And from there we discussed briefly the main qualifications required of an Islamic ruler in an ideal Islamic state.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'd like to, in today's program, begin by some discussion of the method of selecting the ruler in Islam. We're mm-hmm. familiar with the political systems here in the West, with the leadership conferences, the presidential colleges, and so on.
Right.
How is the ruler to be chosen in the Islamic system?
Okay, well, the basic rule, fundamental rule, is that a ruler cannot be imposed on the people. He must be consented to or chosen by the people. When the Quran actually speaks about obedience, say, obey God, obey His messenger, and also those in authority among you or from among you, which means one chosen from among you. As far as the specific mechanism according to which the selection can take place, there is a great deal of flexibility, and that so long as that basic principle of free choice of the people is respected. But perhaps it may be useful, at least at this juncture, to indicate that there is a difference between Sharia and Fiqh. That is, a difference between the basic divine law or basic principle, as the one just cited, which appears in the Quran based on the text or spirit of the revelation, and Fiqh, which is simply jurisprudence or jurisprudence, the way a particular jurist try to interpret those rules, and how could these rules be applied in a given place under certain circumstances or in a given time.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about the ideal mechanism as such, it's very difficult to talk about one mechanism of selection of successors or rulers in a purely Islamic state, because it varies from time to time and from place to place. The principle is always there, but the mechanism could be rather flexible.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you indicated earlier in the series that the prophetic era and the following four caliphs represented the perfect model of the Islamic political system.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to perhaps examine the method of selection in that particular period, beginning, first of all, with the prophetic era. Could you comment on how it was done at that time?
Okay. Well, of course, in the case of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he was in a unique position, combining between two offices, the office of the messenger sent by God to humanity, which is one, and secondly, being also the head of the Muslim community, especially when Muslims migrated after 13 years of torture and persecution in Mecca to Medina, where the genesis of an Islamic state or Islamic community was established. So he was also in a position or office of really the head of that state. But in any case, we find that this was still with the acceptance of the people. Of course, he was not accepted as a prophet. He would not be accepted even as a ruler. And even then, we find that the prophet has accepted bay'ah, which is like a pledge of loyalty or pledge of obedience and acceptance of his leadership in both respects. In fact, he began to exercise this political authority as soon as he went to Medina and with the consent of the inhabitants of Medina. In fact, we find that the oldest constitution, oldest written constitution in the world, was the constitution proposed by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he went to Medina, composed of some 47 articles, which is amazing, really. It could be a subject by itself, but it is far, far ahead of its time. It enunciated certain principles, and in a way, as some Muslim political scientists put it, it established the first in history state in the fullest and true meaning of what the state really means with a written constitution. Some of those basic principles was that tribal relationship should be replaced with the ties of faith. So there's a kind of fusion of tribal ties, replacing it with fusion on the basis of faith. It determined the first head of the state, in this case the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It reiterated the principles of equality, which are enshrined in the Quran and Sunnah, including the protection also of other non-Muslims living under the protection of the Islamic State. Like I said, this could be a subject in itself, especially when you touch on the area of the life of the Prophet and his seerah, or history. But the main point, in any case, is that in the present context, when we deal with political system, that Prophet Muhammad was able to exercise what we call today really a political authority only with the consent and overwhelming acceptance of the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, it's sometimes claimed that the first caliph after Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was chosen by only a very few people. Is that true?
No, it's not true at all. And in fact, it reflects sometimes a confusion between what you might call nomination and actual selection. I know that sometimes that statement is made. While the nomination, or what you might call perhaps accurately, the nomination of Abu Bakr to be the successor of the Prophet was initiated even by one person, was initiated first by Umar, one of the prominent companions. This did not give legitimacy to Abu Bakr to be the leader until the people who were regarded as leaders of their tribes present in that meeting also pledged loyalty to Abu Bakr. And not until the following day, even when he went to the mosque openly in public and the Muslim masses came and expressed their approval through what is called bay'ah, or pledge, that Abu Bakr only was installed officially as the caliph or successor after the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So it was just a nomination, really, not really a choice by a few, but approval was by the masses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure while we're discussing this question of succession, the people might be curious to know whether or not Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, gave any instruction as to who should succeed him as the leader of the Muslims?
No, not really. Before the death of the Prophet, peace be upon him, there is no conclusive evidence at all that he explicitly specified that X or Y should be the successor. In fact, this would have violated even the basic principle that we have spoken about, which are all based on the Quran and his teaching also. And I believe that this is actually a better approach that the Prophet has taken, because if he suggested one particular person or one particular method in succession, it would have been regarded as binding on all Muslims and become extremely inflexible for times to come. Indeed, he left the Muslim Ummah, or the Muslim community, or the community of believers, to settle this and to apply reasoning. And Islam, as you know, as you mentioned before, combines between permanent divine revelations and also the use of the human mind and reasoning to adapt or apply these rules to the circumstances of time and place, or else it would not have been a universal faith for all times and all people. It should have this element of flexibility. There are sometimes references made to the Prophet, peace be upon him, praising some of his major and closest companions, but this applied to more than one. It applied to Ali, his cousin, as much as he praised Abu Bakr and Umar and many others. So they were not only one person that he praised. Sometimes a reference made to the Prophet that he once was quoted as saying that Ali would be a ruler or caliph after me. But this again does not contradict what happened in history. It did not say he will be the first caliph after me. And Ali actually was the fourth caliph after the Prophet. Indeed, there are references that have the same subtle meaning also with respect to other companions, but nobody have ever used this as an evidence or a conclusive evidence that they should have been the first successors of the Prophet. An example, at the time when the Prophet, for example, was ill, he asked Abu Bakr to lead the prayer, and Abu Bakr actually came to be elected as the first caliph, but nobody really used that as the major argument for that, and that might give some hint, but nobody can say it's, you know, conclusive and clear evidence that he specified one person or the other. And I think this was a very appropriate thing, and that leaves the freedom of the people to choose their rulers. After all, there's nobody who is infallible after the Prophet at all. Only prophets are infallible because they are guided by revelation, they're directed by God in what they say. But other human beings, it is left to people to choose who they judge to be as the most qualified to start as the first, second, third, or fourth successor to the Prophet. There's no evidence of that. No.
Well, given that Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, did not specify who should succeed him, how then, historically speaking, was the his first successor or the first caliph chosen?
Okay. When the word got around that the Prophet died, when Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, died, a meeting was held in a place called Saqifat Bani Sa'idah, which is a sort of like meeting hall or community hall. Bani Sa'idah is the name of just the people. And that meeting actually was initiated by the Ansar. Maybe I should clarify the terms here. The people who migrated with Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina because they were persecuted, they were called the Muhajirin, or the migrants. And the original residents of Medina who received them, supported them, and gave refuge to them are called Ansar, literally means supporters. So these terms are relevant here. So the Ansar, or the residents of Medina, initiated that meeting, and one of their prominent leaders by the name of Sa'd ibn Ubadah said that now that the Prophet died, his successor really should be one of you people, the residents of Medina, or the Ansar. Why? He said, after all, you gave refuge to Muslims when they were persecuted, when they migrated here to our city. You participated in protecting Muslims and protecting the Prophet against the campaigns conducted by the pagans. And you made struggle or jihad. You fought for the sake of Islam. When news about that meeting got around and reached Umar, a very prominent companion of the Prophet, as soon as he heard of that meeting, he rushed to the house of the Prophet where his body was being prepared for burial. And he sent to Abu Bakr, another very prominent companion of the Prophet who was also inside. And he said, Abu Bakr, there is something important that happened that you must be present. You must come. So Abu Bakr rushed with Umar. On the way, they were met by a third muhajir, a migrant by the name of Abu Ubaidah. and they all went and joined that particular meeting in order to participate in the discussion. This was the initial forum, if you will, where a succession question was discussed.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, some people may wonder whether or not it was appropriate for Abu Bakr and Omar to go to this meeting before the Prophet was even buried.
Well, Islam is based on principles and not individuals. With all the respect and adoration of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as the model of Islamic teaching, the model of the personality that God sent him to show us the way, Islam is not based on worship of individuals. And the end of the life of individuals neither means the end of Islam itself nor of the political system itself or the order of the Muslim community. Now, one of the principles which is, I believe, universally accepted is that no state, no nation, no group of people should remain without leadership, at least a temporary type of leadership, in any emergency case or for any period of time. Let me give you a couple of examples that perhaps might be familiar with many of the viewers. When President Kennedy was assassinated, nobody said wait until he's buried before some succession or temporary leadership is appointed. To my recollection, long before burial, his then Vice President Lyndon Johnson was sworn in just in the airport, I believe, or something of that sort, just immediately to make sure that there's some continuity of leadership. Relatively more recently, when an attempt on the life of President Reagan was made, and when he was in danger in a hospital, we find again that somebody took charge. I'm not arguing now who should have been in charge or the various claims as to who should have been in power at that time. But again, nobody hesitated or nobody disagreed that somebody should be in charge, aside from burial or non-burial. This matter would have been even more important and more urgent in the case of early Muslims, because in the case of the United States, for example, or other countries, maybe the procedure of succession has been spelled out quite clearly in the Constitution or otherwise. In the case of Muslims, they didn't have all these details, so they have to move, or somebody has to move, to make sure that the problems will not be created in vacuum, will not emerge. And the meeting, since the meeting was held and initiated only by one segment of Muslims, the Ansar, or residents of Medina, this is a serious matter, because the choice of a leader to be accepted by all should not be left in the hands of only a few people to prevent any disorder and dissension. So given the circumstances here and the seriousness of the matter, I think it was very appropriate on the part of Abu Bakr and Omar not to let the problem grow, and to go and participate and try to see how a better procedure for the choice of successor of the Prophet can be initiated. It's a matter of public interest and public order, not just like somebody racing to get a piece of the pie or anything, but it's the interest of the general order and interest of Muslims in general that necessitated that.
Well, we have this meeting being called by Omar with Abu Bakr and so on. What happened when they went to this meeting? What's the outcome?
Okay. When they joined that meeting, which the Ansar, the residents of Medina, started, the discussion seemed to have centered around three basic proposals. The initial proposal is the one cited earlier by Sa'd ibn Ubadah, that it should be one from the residents of Medina. Mm-hmm. And he gave his reasons, the role they played in protecting Muslims and all that. A second suggestion said that the successor of the Prophet should be specifically from one segment of the family of the Prophet, Bani Hashim in particular. And more specifically, the name of Ali, his cousin, was given. A third proposal that prevailed is that there is no need to specify one segment of the family of the Prophet, but since Quraysh is the more prominent tribe, as we indicated earlier, which is likely to be obeyed and accepted by other tribes and least in terms of rebellion and dissension, it would be appropriate to have the successor of the Prophet from among those migrants, those who came from Medina. Other people give additional reasons also that why in the Ansar or Medina residents were very kind and very instrumental in helping the migrants. The migrants also were the first to accept the mission of the Prophet. They've gone through very, very rough time and took all kind of tortures, sacrifices for the sake of Islam. And for all of these reasons together, not just a single one, that particular opinion seemed to have prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how was the question ultimately resolved? How was the decision arrived at? Was it on the basis of party politics, like we see it sometimes today?
Well, it's an interesting question because, in a way, you find some Orientalists who lack some insight in understanding Islam, try to analyze everything, you know, in terms of politics the same way we see it today. MacDonald, for example, one Orientalist once put it, he said that meeting was just like party representatives, you know. But that's not necessarily true, because first of all, there were no parties as such. Of course, the Ansar or residents of Medina could constitute one group as such, but not really a party. And when the three went, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Abu Ubaidah, they did not go in the capacity of representatives of Muhajirin, or else they would be overwhelmed in numbers by the others in the meeting. Now, the other question, which is a legitimate one, was it perhaps more or less like a sort of parties at least trying to settle their affairs? Again, we find that it did not follow what we know today as party politics or party line, that you vote in a partisan way. In fact, when the discussion went on, which I believe was basically a free discussion really, as to who would be more eligible, we find that even an Ansari, a person from the residents of Medina, telling his people and reminding them that after all, if you have given refuge to Muslims, if you have supported the cause of Islam, we have done that only for the pleasure of God and obedience to His Prophet, not for the pursuit of any particular benefit or possession whatsoever. And he was himself an Ansari, so he, of course, in today's terms, would have been dismissed of the party, but he was not really as a party. And more importantly is that when the final discussion proceeded and some crystallization took place as to who should succeed the Prophet, we find that those who were present, even though they were residents of Medina, agreed to a migrant, Abu Bakr, and he was actually chosen. So the mechanism is what you might call free discussion. I'm not again trying to give a misleading picture that it was all very courteous and very easygoing discussion. There were times where there was some emotional outburst, there were strong statements made by this or that, but this is human, this is natural, that people express their ideas and opinions, and it happens today. In parliaments, people sometimes use very strong terms even. So there were argument and discussion, heated at times, but people were convinced of the validity of the argument that Abu Bakr really is the one who should be chosen, mm-hmm. or at least nominated, I should say.
Why, in your view, was it that Abu Bakr received the wide acceptance as the first caliph?
You see, the discussion of the virtues of Abu Bakr is a topic in itself, or the virtues of Ali or any other great companion of the Prophet. I mean, there's so much about them to be said. But in the context here of just the topic, in a very brief way, first of all, the qualities possessed by Abu Bakr made him the clear logical choice to succeed the Prophet, at least for that particular period. First of all, Abu Bakr was the first person to embrace Islam and follow the Prophet among men. As indicated in a previous series, the first person to embrace Islam was a woman, actually, was Khadija, the wife of the Prophet. But the first among men was Abu Bakr. Secondly, Abu Bakr manifested his sincerity, commitment to God, by the many, many sacrifices he did of his own comfort, of his wealth, and he was a wealthy person. He went through lots of persecution and hurt and never wavered in support of Islam and the mission of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. For 13 years he's gone through that. Thirdly, Abu Bakr was a very, very close companion to Prophet Muhammad. He was so close to him, and he learned so much directly from him in words and example. Indeed, as an evidence of how close he was to the Prophet, Abu Bakr alone was the one companion chosen by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to accompany him in a very important and dangerous trip when the Prophet migrated from Mecca to Medina. In fact, the Quran itself makes a reference and describes Abu Bakr as the companion of the Prophet in chapter 9, verse 40. There is another reference to Abu Bakr also in chapter 24, verse 22 in the Quran. But in addition to all of these, as a person even, he had the qualities of compassion, firmness in decision making, and justice, which made him very widely acceptable by the people. I should say again, to be hopefully as accurate as I could, that the choice of Abu Bakr was not unanimous. After all, where in any place where there is truly free choice and free election, a ruler is chosen with 100% of the votes. Whenever you have freedom, there should be people who have different views or feel that another companion is better than he was. There are some who believe that Ali should have been the first caliph, for example. But this is again the freedom that Islam afforded to people to express, and it's a matter of the joint decision and the majority opinion that should prevail. But in any case, there was no question here about the necessity of having a leader, nor on the need to have participation on the part of the people to choose their leaders. Yes, you could have difference as to who should be the leader or the successor of the Prophet, but no difference about its necessity and the right of people to determine who should be that head of the state.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left in today's program. I'd like to just move on to some brief discussion of the selection of the second caliph. Some claim that he was appointed by the first caliph. Is that true?
Well, it's just as true as the previous common question.
Yes.
That again claimed that Abu Bakr, the first caliph, was chosen only by a few. And I hope we have indicated that he was nominated by Omar, chosen by the leader of the people in that meeting, but did not become officially the first caliph until the following day when he went to the masjid, the mosque, and the masses came and expressed their approval. Only then, with this bay'ah, or pledge of allegiance or loyalty, was he installed as a caliph and derived his authority and legitimacy. But by the same token also, what happened is that when Abu Bakr was dying, he gathered some prominent people and he said, why don't you choose one to succeed me so that you don't have or fall into disputation after my death? Because people so much trusted Abu Bakr for his integrity and piety, they said, your opinion is ours. In other words, choose for us, suggest one for us. But that's only nomination, notice.
Mm-hmm.
He said, give me some time. And during that period, he made some consultation and, you know, collected some opinions of prominent people. And then he finally ended up by suggesting Umar. It is reported that when he talked to Umar, even to accept, Umar said, no, it's a big responsibility, you know, I don't want it. You know, and he really pressured him, that Abu Bakr pressured the second caliph, Umar, to accept that responsibility. So even though, again, we find that the method or the mechanism of nomination here differed, again, the same principle is there. It was nothing but a nomination. It did not give legitimacy to Umar as the second caliph until, again, he went to the mosque, the masses came to him, and the public made the pledge of allegiance, and he was actually installed as caliph. So in all cases, it has to be the choice of the people. It's just a process of nomination that suited its time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think on that note, we'll conclude our program for today. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week when we will continue our discussion. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.